Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Dr. Robert Daniel Rubin. After having received his PhD at Indiana University, Dr. Rubin has continued his career as a writer of academic and journalistic material, an interviewer, an online and archival researcher, workshop facilitator, and a designer of college curricula. He has classroom experience teaching in history, writing, and American studies, and is also a public speaker on numerous topics, including the role of politics, religion, and ideas in society. He has published works in the Journal of Church and State, a chapter in a volume entitled The Right Side of the 60s, and recently penned the book Judicial Review and American Conservatism, Christianity, Public Education, and the Federal Courts in the Reagan Era, released recently by Cambridge University Press. Publishing with Cambridge is a notable feat for an independent scholar, since most texts with that press are from university-affiliated professors. But the book is of remarkable high quality and well-deserving of such a distinguished printing. We will link to that book on our website, and it will also be the topic of our conversation today. I should also note that Robert is working on another manuscript that grapples with how prayer and spiritual contemplation affect people's capacities as civic actors. This project examines the problem of how differently inclined individuals can develop the ability and willingness to speak across their differences and help heal our nation's civic discourse. Well, let's start a discourse here then. Robert, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Great. Let's start out with a little bit of your personal intellectual history, since I always think it's important to find out the background of authors as a way of understanding what piques their interest. So what motivated you to pursue a PhD, and how did you end up in Seattle, Washington, writing a book on judicial activism and Christianity that focuses on events in all places, Mobile, Alabama, in the 1980s? Triangulate that for us, if you could.
That's great to have the opportunity to reflect on that. I began graduate studies and completed them because, well, there was nothing else I was ready and willing to do other than to read, write, and teach. I didn't have the luck I anticipated I would have finding a tenure-track job. And so I decided to move with my family to Seattle, Washington for a whole host of reasons. And doing so and not teaching and just writing has given me the opportunity to think in new ways, to do things I wouldn't have done before. Getting involved in nonprofit work has been really instrumental to my path and has gotten me to think about how in the real world people grapple with, either consciously or unconsciously, the same kinds of issues that academics concern themselves with. And so I see that at once as an expansion and an evolution of my interests. And while I would certainly consider a tenure track offer, doing so would require giving up or changing my current endeavors.
So you pick Seattle, Washington, to come to. Had you grown up here, or is it just you threw a dart at the map and ended up here and you like the Seahawks or something? What's the deal with Seattle?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't dare throw darts, but my wife is from here.
Okay.
And she hadn't lived here for over 20 years. And so I guess the immediate impetus for coming here was to take care of family and to be around family. But it was fortuitous that she lived or that she grew up in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. Well, here we are in Seattle. We're live, kind of more or less live doing this. And we want to talk about your book now. And I really love this book for graduate students and even faculty members are out there. It's really, really well written because it has a lot of very personalistic anecdotes about individuals. The characters really come to life. And it's also a really intellectually deep book.
it has this wide-ranging theoretical understanding of religion and politics, yet it also zeroes in on a specific set of court cases involving religion and public education, most notably Jaffrey versus Board of School Commissioners of Mobile County, and then also an earlier case, Smith v. Board of School Commissioners. And then also a bunch of decisions made by Judge Brevard Hand down in Alabama, and he's going to play a big role in our discussion today, I think. But your work also weaves these specific moments in time and place with broader trends in American society. So I want to start broad before we get narrow. Explain to us from your research perspective what is happening with respect to religion and American politics and culture for roughly two decades prior to these court decisions.
First of all, you know, I think today we tend to think about the Christian right or religious right as an entity that has existed for a long time. And it hasn't existed that long of a time, at least not in the way that we think of it now. The South that I'm studying, there wasn't much working together, much collaboration between, say, evangelicals and fundamentalists to their right. And certainly there was not much of an interweaving between Protestants and Catholics at that time, so that there really isn't, you know, in the South and I would say elsewhere, anything we could call a conservative religious movement. I'll speak about the South for a moment.
Sure.
Although I think that this really applies to the United States as a whole. The first rapprochement between evangelicals and fundamentalists to their right comes with the 1960 election and the prospect of having a Catholic in the White House. And that motivates a whole range of actors across the theological Protestant range to oppose Kennedy. So, I mean, and interestingly enough, they oppose him on grounds of his Catholicism, so that there certainly at this point isn't yet any kind of alliance between Catholics and Protestants. That begins to change in the years following Kennedy's election. And I guess three things happen. Three events really begin to build what we would today call a Christian right, and especially in the South. And I think the South is important here because of the racial factor and the ways in which race, you know, really supplants sectarian divisions as the predominant force in the Christian right in the South. The first of those three things are the Supreme Court decisions regarding or outlawing the out loud recitation of prayer in public schools. That was the Engel case in 1962, and the Abington v. Shemp case in 1963, outlawing Bible reading in public school classrooms. And in the minds of many, many white evangelicals and fundamentalists, this is all of a part, that there's something deeply connected between what the Supreme Court has been doing regarding race and what the Supreme Court is now doing regarding religion. And many people make that explicit connection. And you begin to see Southerners supporting constitutional amendments to bring about, to legalize, constitutionalize school prayer. The second thing is the July 1964 Civil Rights Act passed by Lyndon Johnson, which he correctly saw would galvanize the White South against him for decades to come. And shortly after that, Barry Goldwater's courting of the South and alliance with Strom Thurmond and turning five Deep South states Republican during the 64 convention, which was really at that time unheard of. I mean, white Southerners didn't vote for the party of Lincoln. So those three events set things in motion, I would say. And I don't know if you want me to continue on with that line right now.
Yeah, continue. I mean, there's a lot of griping going on. There's a lot of things that I don't like in the world too. But what mobilizes them? Is there some methods of them bringing them together, figuring out how to act as a collective, or is it just the mutual gripes that they have bring them together.
Right. Well, I mean, the story of the coming together through the, you know, the famous organizations of the 1970s, you know, Christian Voice and Religious Roundtable and eventually Moral Majority, really those are the vehicles that propel them into politics. But I would say that prior to that, there is a more, you know, amorphous but yet very prominent force that I think brings them towards that, and that is anti-judicialism. The federal courts and the Supreme Courts had for quite a while, especially since Brown v. Board, had been seen as a force that was not only foreign to the white South, but in some ways attempting to, you know, overturn, eradicate their sovereignty. You know, that the people of Mississippi or Alabama had the right through their elected representatives to make the laws that they chose to make. And the Supreme Court in particular begins to draw their ire. And there are four Supreme Court decisions in particular that cause white Christians in the South to come together, I think, if not yet organizationally, at least, you know, intellectually and in some sense spiritually. And you have the Loving v. Virginia decision in 67, which overturned a Virginia law that outlawed interracial relationships. You have the Epperson v. Arkansas decision in 68 that outlawed the prohibition of the teaching of evolution in the classroom. You have Roe v. Wade in 73. And you have Bob Jones University versus the United States. Bob Jones University had famously disallowed interracial dating and marriages. And these four decisions are seen, I think, by white Southerners as not only an affront to their sensibilities, but an attack on their right to make the laws of their choosing. I think that this provides the groundwork for all the famous organizations of the 70s that then propel these people into organized politics.
One thing I want to back up with, and I think this is kind of interesting for a number of our listeners who might consider evangelicals and fundamentalists to be different. You mentioned that – or excuse me, to be the same. You mentioned that they were at odds or at least different than one another. What's the difference between an evangelical and a fundamentalist?
You know, I want to defer to the theological historians who really can speak to that more. I will say that the influence of the National Association of Evangelicals and Billy Graham, really, in the 1950s, was a moderating force and gave evangelicals an identity separate from fundamentalists. I mean, there were theological issues as well that I'm really not as well versed in, but they weren't the fervent anti-communists, say, of, let's say, Carl McIntyre and Billy James Hargis were in the South. That was the real, I think, big difference. They also were more moderate regarding the early civil rights movement. They waffled, whereas there was no waffling among fundamentalists. So these differences were political as much as they were theological.
Now, you focus a lot here on the South, and specifically Alabama becomes the crucible for some of these cultural and political contexts that are coming to a head in the 1970s. And one would think that Alabama is pretty isolated from much of the social change, and we would see more ferment in places like New England and that. But give us a sense for how these general trends you just discussed earlier here play out in Alabama, and specifically why you chose Mobile, Alabama, as a focal point of your study.
Right. I think that Alabama's isolation from social changes made it more likely to resist and to be a useful focal point for a kind of, in many ways, to a point, a backward-looking politics. Not entirely, but to a point. And there was something about the Deep South in general, I think, that was highly charged. It was said that America was becoming Southernized during this time, but I think that the South remained the most Southern part of the country. As far as Mobile goes, Mobile had long been known within Alabama as a tolerant city, really more like, say, New Orleans than the rest of Alabama. Had a large Catholic population, and it was a fairly liberal, tolerant place as far as Alabama went. And that changed during the World War II years as federal contractors opened plants there and drew in A lot of people from throughout the South, a lot of, you know, former sharecroppers and the like, and they brought with them a much more, say, Manichaean mentality and a fundamentalist worldview that changed Mobile's character very much. In fact, according to one historian, it became, at least in terms of its mentality, the most fundamentalist, politically speaking, the most fundamentalist city in Alabama. So although I didn't seek out Mobile initially, I didn't seek out any particular location initially, once I saw that my study was rooted in Mobile, it really was an ideal place for it to be situated.
Yeah, let me just ask you for a moment how you stumbled upon this, because there's a lot of court cases and a lot of different things you could see out there. Was there something that you were just reading, or you heard something in the news, or somebody nudged you on the side and said, hey, you got to look at this Mobile thing? How did you come to this specific topic and time and place?
Yeah. I was, you know, when I began my doctoral work, I was drawn towards exploring what I consider to be deep conflict, not easily resolved. And I came to see that, for me, kind of religion versus non-religion or religion versus secularism was especially intractable or difficult to assuage. So I was looking for, you know, conflicts of this sort. I became attracted to court cases, and then I found two court cases separately that really spoke to these issues in slightly different ways. And after exploring them, I realized that, in fact, these were different moments in a single conflict. The Jaffrey case, which took place in 1982, 1983, and then went to the Supreme Court in 85. And the Smith case, which took place in 86, 87, these were kind of highlights and signals for a very robust and kind of crazy conflict that took place in Mobile throughout this entire period.
So let's go ahead and turn to those court cases. And I think earlier on I mentioned that the Smith case came before the Jaffrey case. So I was wrong there. It was Jaffrey first and then Smith v. Board, and both of them involved the Board of School Commissioners. Give us an idea of what is going on in each of these cases, and let's start with the earlier one, the Jaffrey case.
Okay, and I'll try to be succinct here. an atheist parent of public school children found out in 1981 that his children in their classroom were exposed to out loud recited prayer on a daily basis. This rankled him, and it actually gave him the fight that he was, you know, looking for. And he was a devout atheist. He complained to school teachers to no avail. He complained to their principals to no avail. He complained to the superintendent of schools and heard nothing back. And so he brought suit. And he saw that his case was very similar to the 1962 Engel case, and so he thought he had kind of a slam dunk case. It became even more similar to Engel when the case got a lot of publicity. The governor of Alabama, Fob James Jr., heard about it and decided to make a case to insert himself into the case by successfully shepherding through the legislature of Alabama a law explicitly sanctioning school prayer. And in fact, the law contained a prayer that could be recited, and the prayer was written by none other than the governor's son, Fob James III. So the devout atheist in the case, whose name was Ishmael Jaffrey, decided that he was going to include the governor and the state of Alabama in his suit. I don't think he expected to run into the judge that he did. Judge Brevard Hand was well known throughout Alabama as somebody who was a strict constructionist. He was a Nixon appointee, a strict constructionist, a constitutional originalist, and while a very genteel man, was also, you know, did what he could to slow down the pace of desegregation, really in accord with a political theory and a constitutional theory that saw this as the product of kind of federal court invasion of the South. And so he was going to resist that invasion from within. Brevard Hand would find against Jaffrey. Okay. And he would be very swayed by the expert testimony of the school board. The expert for the school board was a man named James McClellan, who was high ranking in a cadre of right-wing constitutionalists. He had served as an aide to Senators Orrin Hatch and Jesse Helms. He was well-placed within kind of the counter-establishment that had asserted itself now in the Reagan Justice Department. He had written some influential books and articles. He was sought out by the Mobile School Board to be their expert witness. And he laid out a fairly radical constitutional vision that Judge Hand made his own. Especially, he said, in fact, the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment that was really the basis for church-state separation. He said, well, since the Establishment Clause specifies that Congress shall make no law establishing a religion, well, in fact, this shouldn't and in reality doesn't apply to the individual states, despite what the Supreme Court had said for several decades. And Judge Hand accepted that idea and made it the basis for his ruling. Judge Hand was overturned by the 11th Circuit, and the Supreme Court would uphold the 11th Circuit's reversal. And it, in dissent, Justice Rehnquist wrote a very acerbic and far-reaching denunciation of the church, of the court's entire 40-year church-state jurisprudence. But of course, Justice Rehnquist was writing in dissent, and so the case was remanded back to Judge Hand, and Hand was told to make sure that the state of Alabama establish no religion.
So we have that case, and then roughly 4 or so years later, we get Smith v. Board of School Commissioners. These guys must be getting tired of litigating all the time. If I was on the board, I think I'd resign. But what happens in Smith v. Board? Because different character in Smith here than Jaffrey.
Right, right. Going back to Jaffrey for a second, we had the atheist, Ishmael Jaffrey, attacking the school board, saying that it violated the Establishment Clause because it had established the religion of Christianity. In that case, a group intervened, a group of local evangelicals intervened and created a kind of odd symmetry. While Jaffrey was attacking the school board for establishing Christianity, these evangelicals ended up attacking the school board for establishing the religion of secular humanism. And, you know, which is a kind of a worldview that is built on, you know, a resistance to the scientific method, to rationalities, hegemony in the classroom, to, you know, kind of a relativity in all kinds of things, you know, ethical and intellectual. And so these interveners in Jaffrey said, we as Christians are a minority whose rights are being violated by the Mobile School Board. Now, neither Jaffrey nor the interveners played a role in Judge Hand's decision, because he was ultimately saying, you know, the federal court should beg out of this. Once the case was remanded back to Judge Hand, he said, okay, I'm going to revisit what the interveners had said. And Judge Hand had been paying attention to a lot of currents at this time among Christian conservative litigators who were now beginning to say, if we can't beat the courts, let's join them. Let's pose ourselves as an aggrieved minority. And so the interveners did just that, and Judge Hand named them as plaintiffs in a new case where they became the ones who took on the Mobile School Board in the state of Alabama and said that those bodies were establishing the religion of secular humanism. This case was very colorful. It brought in a lot of interesting scholars from different fields who made this argument that secular humanism was a religion, that it was being established in the textbooks being used in Mobile, and that violated the Establishment Clause. Good arguments were made on the other side as well, but Judge Hand was really committed to the arguments of the plaintiffs, and he ruled in their favor. I believe that Judge Hand's ruling was tongue-in-cheek. I don't think he ever intended secular humanism or the scientific method to be eliminated from the classroom. He knew that that would A, would never happen, and B, wouldn't be an especially good thing. What he was trying to do with his Smith ruling was to say, look, if the federal courts are going to be involved in purging religion from the classroom, and if they're really going to do it even-handedly, it's going to be an undoable task. I mean, it just – you really can't do it, at least not even-handedly. I'm going to show you what an undoable task it is. I'm going to give you a broad definition of religion – and show you how unwieldy it is to remove religion from the textbooks. Maybe now you'll see the problems with your jurisprudence, you Supreme Court. It didn't get to the Supreme Court, you know, sadly, in Judge Hand's view, but it left an imprint on American jurisprudence.
Yeah, this is interesting characters in this case. We want to talk about Judge Hand here in a second, but what about the Smith guy? You mentioned that Judge Hand appointed these folks plaintiffs, and there's somebody named Smith who's going to be appointed here. Who is this Smith guy?
He's actually a relatively minor player here, a very nice man, actually. His name went onto the case because he was the first person listed in among the plaintiffs, or the original interveners, now plaintiffs. He was a science teacher, an eighth grade science teacher, and a very earnest man who saw his own values being eroded by church-state separation.
Yeah, I just bring that up because sometimes these cases that get these grandiose names, you wonder, how did this person end up? And sometimes it's just kind of a random roll of the dice how we need somebody. So you standing over there, you're the closest. So get over here and pick that. So very interesting. Now, you mentioned Judge Hand here, Brevard Hand. And you had the opportunity to interview him extensively in this book, and you write a very, very interesting thing in the acknowledgments here. And I want to read this because you don't see this very often when you talk about a lot of people that you interview and often disagree with. You write, "This book could not have been written without the generosity of Brevard Hand. Graciously, Judge Hand created a space for us to disagree amicably. I will always appreciate his kindness." Tell us, first of all, about this guy personally, if you have a little bit of background on him and just kind of his personality, and then we'll dig into his judicial philosophy, his political philosophy then.
Sure. He was – well, before I met him, I didn't know what to expect. I sent him a letter explaining that I really wanted to talk to him, to interview him for my doctoral dissertation, and to speak as, you know, openly and fairly as I could, and to assure him that I wasn't a journalist trying to you know, employ kind of gotcha journalism. And he wrote back and he said, he wrote back a rather long letter and said, "I need to meet you first before I'll talk to you, and I will not cast my pearls before swine." And that's a quote. So I traveled to Mobile, and he seemed to be a very nice man, very genteel, invited me into his chamber and said, "So tell me, what are you up to here?" And he didn't interrupt me, and I spoke for probably 45 minutes. And then he said, "Okay, well, what would you like to do with me?" And we both spoke a little more, and then he said, "I'd be happy to participate." I would end up speaking with him either 5 or 6 times extensively. And it was clear from the beginning that we understood politics differently, and probably as a result of that, we understood judicial philosophy differently, although he would not admit to a close connection between politics and judicial philosophy. He was, again, in a way I couldn't relate to him just because of, you know, his kind of lofty social status, but he was very forthcoming and very accommodating and would take me out to lunch and would clear out his schedule to talk to me and would introduce me to people around the courthouse and introduce me to his wife. And I don't know that I could have produced the dissertation that I did without having had that personal and candid access to him.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And part of the research process that we don't often hear about, we don't see in the books or the articles that oftentimes come out, but your characterization of him is very interesting. And as a graduate student going down there, going into this judge's chambers the first time, I'm sure you're a little bit nervous, like, oh my gosh, what's going to go on? And I, if you could just kind of give us a visual of this, was Judge Brevard Hand one of these typical Southern judges that you might see, the stereotype? Type, you know, large man suspenders, you know, with the mint julep and things like this? And what did his chambers look like? And where did you go for lunch? Those are kind of odd questions I always like to know about.
He, despite his, you know, affinities with Judge Roy Moore, the you know, famous Alabama judge who most recently has come out strongly against the Obergefell case, Judge Hand is not like Roy Moore, either in temperament or appearance. He was a tall, rather lean man, very stately, very genteel, and although in my mind he still very much exists. He was not a firebrand temperamentally. He belonged to a rather liberal church and would very amicably debate the church's pastor. He believed in religious and political pluralism, although he tied that to conservative ways of thinking and acting, and ultimately to freedom of thought. And he had a very interesting kind of political philosophy. So he is not that typical, you know, suspenders wearing and maybe even tobacco spitting Southern judge that's, you know, kind of in the imagination, particularly of Northern liberals. He was not that man.
So you mentioned his political philosophy and then also relatedly his judicial philosophy. These tend to be two peas in the same pod here. Go ahead and discuss this. You talk about several points of his book. He talked about Republican majoritarianism, federalism, and the issue of political self-reliance. So how does this all wrap up in his mind?
Like some other Southern Christian whites of the era, he understood his views in principled and even theoretical terms, although he did not fancy himself a theoretist by any means. He understood American republicanism and Christianity as two parts of a whole. And he was not alone in thinking this way. And I think you see elements of this in other thinkers, most notably the political scientist Wilmore Kendall, but others as well. You see traces of it in William Buckley and Russell Kirk as well. For Judge Hand, there was something that the right and ability of the American people to participate in the lawmaking process was not only a good thing, but a necessary thing, that's who we were. I think he understood the role of the courts as and judicial review or robust judicial review as being a counter-majoritarian difficulty, you know, in the words of Alexander Bakel. He understood self-government as taking place among legislatures where a self-reliant and free-thinking people would discuss and debate and decide the most important laws, including laws that reflected moral sensibilities. Those things should not be cordoned off from the lawmaking process. Quite the opposite. They should inform the lawmaking process. And, of course, as legislatures do, they would decide laws based on the majority rule. And he saw this as a good thing, although he wasn't He wasn't somebody who believed in the plebiscite. He was not a kind of a direct democracy defender, but he did believe that there was something right and good about majority rule. In turn, self-government among a free-thinking, freely acting, self-reliant people, self-government reinforced the kinds of virtues and skills that a free people needed to have and to inculcate in young people. And these included Christianity, which for him included the free market system, and a real kind of self-reliant individualism and obedience toward properly established authority. And Christianity in particular and the capitalist system would inculcate in young people, especially in the schools, a self-reliance, a self-discipline that would prepare them for self-government. So there's a reflexivity here between self-reliance and self-government that was central to his thinking and central to his judicial philosophy, which really was to limit the ability of the federal courts in particular to interfere with the lawmaking process, especially in the individual states where the lawmaking process was most pure and where popular majorities would be most able to create the laws of their choosing.
I have an interesting question. When you were in Judge Hand's chambers or elsewhere, did you ever look at his bookshelves and see what he had on his shelves? I mean, you always have the legal books and they all look very nicely, but I mean, I'm hearing a little bit of Tocqueville, maybe not just a little bit, maybe a lot of it of Tocqueville in here. I'm wondering if that was sitting prominently somewhere on his desk.
You know, I have to say for the most part, I don't remember, with one exception.
Okay.
I remember seeing, maybe even out on his desk, The Mind of the South. And that famous book in the 1940s, which put out, you know, I don't think it was called a conservatism then, but it became the backbone of, I would say the backbone of the conservatism that emerged post-1960s, the idea that there's something central and good about prejudice and prejudice in the best sense of the word, a reliance on mores and established ways of being and acting, and a kind of folk ways also. As I think the historian Eugene Genovese has rightly pointed out, this is central to conservatism. And I think Judge Hand understood that. Beyond that book, I don't recall the other books on his shelves.
Okay. Who is the author of The Mind of the South?
Oh, Cash, and I want to say Wilbur Cash, but I bet I'm wrong.
Okay. Well, we can look it up and might have a link to it on our website as well as some of the other things that you mentioned here as well. One of the things that you opened with too, to kind of give us an insight into Judge Hand's philosophy, there was this Law Day speech that he gave. What was that about? That seems to ring large in his pantheon here.
Right. That speech drew together these themes. What's really, I think, significant about that, and this was a speech that he gave to a group of lawyers that were assembled. The speech was given in 1986, after the point when he had put the pieces of the Smith trial, the second trial, into motion. In fact, this was after he had received the briefs of the plaintiffs, presumably after he had begun grappling with these briefs. And certainly he understood the implications of the Smith trial. So here he was publicly, before the trial, laying out the ideas that would be central to his opinion in the trial about the importance of self-reliance and about people not relying on government to do their, you know, to act as political actors.
And how was that speech received at the time? I can imagine if a judge goes up and starts talking about cases that he's litigating on or that he's part of deciding on, a lot of people would lose their minds.
I think that it flew under the radar. And I think that despite his Jaffrey opinion a few years earlier, he flew under the radar until Smith. Now, locally, it might, you know, I don't even know that locally it really got noticed very much.
Interesting. Yeah, when lawyers start talking, I tend not to notice things either, too. So, and judges and things like that. You talk a lot about how Judge Hand shaped the dialogue and the decision that came about both in Jaffrey and then in Smith. This isn't somebody just says, okay, everybody talks and I'll sit back and, you know, ponder this and that. But he becomes involved. So tell us about his judicial activism and in the way you describe it in the text.
Well, I guess a bit of context is due here. Up until about 1980, the attempts by conservatives to reverse the school prayer decisions and other decisions, abortion, school busing, their attempts were really majoritarian. They were attempts to get to limit the jurisdiction over the federal courts in matters involving prayer and abortion and things such as that. Those efforts were led largely by Jesse Helms and John East in the Senate and by a lot of others. Those efforts came to naught. The majoritarian tack, trying to get the federal courts out of the business of enforcing civil liberties and civil rights especially against southern states, just it didn't come to pass. And many astute Christian conservative litigators and others recognized that there was a better philosophy available, that they too could adopt a civil libertarian stance and seek out the assistance of the Supreme Court by asserting their own civil liberties as an aggrieved minority. And I refer to this in the book as the civil libertarian turn. Judge Hand saw this. He knew about it. The interveners in Jaffrey had done this. And so, on the one hand, the Jaffrey decision's impact was big, and it got noted in all the branches of government. And ultimately, Ronald Reagan's personal advisor and his later Attorney General Edwin Meese went on a public tirade against the Supreme Court for their rulings in Jaffrey, and he mentioned Judge Hand by name. So Judge Hand, his Jaffrey opinion had an impact, but it was really – ultimately its biggest impact would come, I think, much later, and particularly in the writings of Clarence Thomas. For that time, the majoritarian tack didn't have that much influence. It wasn't really working. When Judge Hand kind of reoriented himself in Smith, he produced an opinion that on the one hand he relied on the Establishment Clause to strike down the religion of secular humanism. And that particular strategy didn't have a lot of influence. But his willingness to acknowledge Christian conservatives as a minority under siege and being kind of their rights being violated within public institutions, his willingness to acknowledge this and to make this the basis of his federal court decision was pretty new. There aren't many traces. Certainly calling on secular humanism as the establishment religion was completely new. And that would have ripple effects on Christian conservative litigators who now saw that there were opportunities to call on a kind of even-handedness between religion and non-religion.
You talk about the ripple effects here, and you also mentioned the impact that it had on Clarence Thomas. That is where I want to take this next. We talked about the specific battles here in Mobile, Alabama, and how Judge Hand himself did this, but what were the bigger political, legal, and perhaps even cultural, religious effects that come out of these battles in the early to mid-1980s in Alabama?
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking there. I mean, you're not talking about the judiciary here. Are you so can you restate that, please?
Yeah, sure. You mentioned ripple effects, and those ripple effects I think are kind of interesting. The ripple effects are going to, as you already noted, affect the judicial strategy of a number of Christian conservatives. But does it ripple more broadly in our political worldviews, how politics has played out over the last few decades, and also religiously and culturally? I mean, how has this impacted the way that religious folks look at the world and things like that? It's pretty broad. Broad question.
Right. No, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. Prior to his Smith ruling, there was a small and largely obscure cottage industry of writers proclaiming that secular humanism was a religion. This was not well known. After his decision, which gained a lot of notoriety and made it into national newspapers, after that, he brought this idea that somehow that secularism was the dominant worldview and even that it was the dominant religion of America. He brought this into prominence. He wasn't alone, and I should mention here that the theologian Francis Schaeffer also, you know, played a big role in this, maybe even bigger than Hand. But Hand did it in the political arena, and this becomes a cornerstone of the rhetoric of the Christian right. I mean, it becomes the biggest single argument, I would say, for Christians trying to catapult themselves into politics. As a way of saying, we have been marginalized and we need to insert ourselves. And, you know, I think that affects, you know, litigation again, but it affects people like Ralph Reed and James Dobson, who use this rhetoric a lot. I think that's Judge Hand's biggest contribution to politics outside of the judiciary.
Let's talk about some of the broader takeaways from these cases and the battles that were going on there. In your book, you mentioned that early on that you see the Constitution as continually evolving. Discuss what you mean by that in context of what this case helped you learn about the entire process.
Mm. Well, this idea of a living Constitution had, you know, at least the idea of it, was begun during the Supreme Court under Earl Warren and was the motivating force, I would say, behind the assertion of civil rights, the rights of minorities in particular. William O. Douglas and William Brennan became exponents of it. And William Brennan would be, by the time of the Jaffrey case, William Brennan was the representative of this idea that the Constitution isn't frozen in time. It doesn't. It's not simply the product of what its framers either said explicitly in the text or what they intended to say. That certainly the framers never talked about it as frozen or originalist, and so neither should we talk about it as frozen in time. Rather, it's something that was meant to evolve and, in fact, has always evolved and should evolve. And because Brennan understood, judicial politics as a moral endeavor, and he was very dedicated to defending the rights of the powerless, he made special use of this idea of the living Constitution and the idea more generally that ideas and kind of sociological ideas and psychological ideas should inform decision making. That really, it's not just about the letter of the law. If we constrain ourselves to the letter of the law when we render decisions, we miss the really important work that judicial decisions are meant to do in our society. Of course, you know, we have the rise of originalism at this time and strict constructionism that attempt to refute this. And of course, Rehnquist sees himself as the kind of the opposite end of the Supreme Court from Brennan. Originalism gains a lot of traction. You know, it becomes the impetus behind the Federalist Society and others. Interestingly enough, though, the idea of a living constitution continues on today in the court. It has for a while with Justice O'Connor, and now mostly with Justice Kennedy. And it's a way of, I think, of liberals in the court saying, we're not just about liberal politics, we're about something bigger. And having Kennedy to decide certain decisions that go their way is important because he puts their decisions in a bigger, more principled framework, that it's not just that we have a liberal constitution or even that we're defending minorities, but that we have to understand the constitution in broad, principled, kind of extrajudicial terms.
So interesting takeaways there. The one thing I want to finish up with here, and it's a question that I always like to ask of my scholars, is your personal reflection on writing this book and doing all the research. Was there ever or was there anything that you changed your mind about during the journey of this scholarship, something that surprised you or anything that – so at a certain point in time, you walk into this project and then you come out the other side and you look backwards and say, oh, I didn't think about that before.
I began my work as a strict separationist. I didn't even think much about it. I mean, to me, separation of church and state was something that I just took for granted. I mean, obviously, there should be a wall of separation between the two. And I came to see this issue as more problematic. I think through my work, I came to see the issue through the eyes of all my actors. And this included the conservatives who understood themselves as losers in the trajectory of American church-state politics. And as losers in what they saw as a really unfair and discriminatory body of law, church-state law, that was inherently unjust and inherently undemocratic, I began to see how it affected them, that people didn't just – they weren't religious just in you know, their private prayers or what they did in the church or in the home, but that – you know, religion truly was lived by many people, is lived by many people. And so I understood the costs of separation of church and state. I don't know that it has changed my views about, you know, whether prayer should be in the classroom. But, you know, I think that and on a personal level that I, you know, over the years, you know, developed spiritual inclinations and begun to understand, you know, the role that meditation could have in my life and even prayer, it didn't change my political views, but it did make me more sympathetic to people who saw themselves as victims of church-state separation. I can't believe I just outed myself here.
There you go. But this is kind of interesting, and I can see how this is becoming part of your next project. And so to finish up here with, give us a foreshadow of things to come. What you talk about your next project as being a study of how prayer and spiritual contemplation affect people's capacity as civic actors. Where is this all going?
Yeah, and it really is in process of being worked out. So there's a couple things here. What I'm mostly interested in is figuring out and teasing out how, first of all, how people who pray and meditate understand themselves as civic actors and how they understand their own political inclinations and how they might connect those to their own spiritual or religious practices. I also want to dig a bit deeper and see how, in fact, these connections might exist. There are several ways I want to get at this, but primary here is doing a lot of interviews with people, a wide range of people throughout the United States, and teasing this out and getting a kind of on-the-ground and very visceral understanding of you know, what potential might there be within within prayer, meditation, or resistance to prayer and meditation in perhaps creating a more, oh, a more amicable or respectful space between people with differing political views, or at least in some ways getting them not to want to kill each other so much. I also want to do workshops and perhaps even focus groups where I see where I can see what impact there might be of some of these spiritual practices on how people kind of interact with others who don't share their inclinations.
Very, very cool research. This is something we'll be looking forward in the future, and hopefully we'll be able to speak with you about it as it gets put into print. So we will take a look for that. My guest today has been Robert Daniel Rubin. Robert, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.